Excision number 12910, Reel 1.
Mr. Imre, Reel 1, whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Sutton, Surrey.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a cartographer. He was, in fact, a partner in one of the oldest, what was one of the oldest firms in the City of London. They were called Imre, Norrie and Wilson. And I believe the firm is still going, but not under the same name.
Were you educated in Sutton?
In Sutton, for a very brief time, in a school called Homefield, which I think is still going. Then I was sent away to Margate, a school in Margate. And then I went on to Malvern College, Malvern, in Worcestershire.
Now, you were telling me earlier that in 1928, when you must have been about 19, you went out to Malaya. How did that come about, please?
Well, I was, after leaving Malvern, I was put into a firm in London called Lewis Lazarus Tin Merchants. Well, they had an agency, what they called an agency department, and they had affiliations with Malaya. I worked for about 8 or 9 months with the firm in London, the agency department in London, and they were, in effect, an agency between the manufacturers in Britain and Europe generally, and the Straits, as we used to call Malaya. So I was earmarked to go out to Malaya for the firm, and in due course I did.
What were you supposed to do for them out there?
Learn the job of liaising with the local Chinese and Indian merchants. Selling them the products of the manufacturers in Britain and Europe generally, and getting out and around the country.
What were the main problems you had in doing that work?
Probably the chief problem was that I was so very young, I think. I learnt the language, which is a sort of dog Malay, a rather sketchy Malay. I learnt that very easily, and I was very proficient at it. But I think my main handicap was extreme youth and inexperience. However, I got all over the country and had a very good time. I played all games and reasonably proficiently. And I saw a great deal of the country.
What were conditions like in Malaya in the 28-31 period?
Very imperial, indeed. It was gradually, I think, getting more Chinese inhabited. The Malays... one didn't really meet very much, and it's one went out of one's way to find them, which I did, because I found them the most charming, delightful people. I had a lot to do with the Chinese, business-wise, and eventually, for the last 3 years of my time in Malaya, I was put on to selling cigarettes. Our agents were Carreras. Carreras, the big cigarette manufacturers. And our job was to peddle these brands of cigarettes in the Straits for Carreras.
In what way was it so imperial in those days?
So far as I'm aware, there were very, very few... other than British, in positions of command, in positions of management, of administration, or anything of the sort. The Indian imperial model, I think, was followed fairly exactly. There was a great deal of wining, dining, dancing in the clubs and the hotels among simply the Europeans, with very little mixing. That's really what I think I tend to convey by the term imperial.
Was there any evidence to you of discontent on the part of the Chinese, Malay or Indian populations there?
The Chinese were, I think it's right to say, the Chinese were getting apprehensive about Japanese infiltrations and Japanese... I'm not sure whether I'm right over this. I think the Japanese had already got into Manchuria, but I'm not sure of that. And I think that there was apprehension about the Japanese on the part of the Chinese.
Did they make those feelings evident to you as you discussed them?
My contact, of course, would simply be in coffee houses, among the Chinese merchants. Yes, we did have talks about that sort of thing, but, of course, I was very, very young and not much of it stuck or impressed itself much on me at that stage. I think that my reactions to Malaya really were, I loved the country, I found it glamorous, exciting. I liked the Chinese. I liked the Malays. I didn't care much for the Indians that I met. I think my main preoccupation was getting out and around and seeing as much of the country as I could.
What was your dislike as far as the Indians were concerned?
I don't think I saw enough of them. They were a very close-knit lot of people. They didn't seem to me to be nearly as outgoing as the Chinese at that time. And as I say, my contacts with the Indians were probably fairly limited, although there were a number of merchants there that I used to have to see, but to nothing like the same extent as the Chinese.
Did you ever get anybody who said to you, we don't like the way you British are running things here, and why are you here in any case?
So far as I can remember, I don't think that ever occurred, not as far as I was concerned. The general impression I had was that there was a general air of contentment. I think that... I very occasionally had somewhat ribald remarks put to me about the Europeans' closed shop clubs. I seem to remember that very occasionally.
From Chinese?
From Chinese, yes. Not from Malays.
So they wanted to mix socially?
I'm not sure that they particularly wanted to mix socially. I think they regarded themselves as very self-sufficient. But I think they were slightly amused at the close-knit European cliques.
Any incidents which happened to you whilst you were in Malaya that we can record, which stick in your memory?
Yes. I was a member of the volunteer, the Malay States Volunteer Corps. Indeed, most young men who went out to the firms, and there were many mercantile houses in Malaya in those days, there were Busteds, Guthries, William Jacks, a lot of them. Anyway, most young men who went out for their firms were usually impressed into the Malay States Volunteer Reserve, Volunteer Corps. I remember one occasion where there was a two-day field exercise where we were in camp there, and we were addressed by the GOC Malaya, whose name I can't remember now. This must have been 28, the end of 28, possibly beginning of 29, I'm not sure. But he addressed us, and the tenor of his address was that Malaya was a fortress, Singapore was a fortress. This was in Singapore, on Singapore Island. Singapore was an impregnable fortress. And a great deal of money had been spent, and a great deal of thought had been put into the defences of Singapore. I was very new in Singapore at the time. Perhaps I'd only been there 2 or 3 months. I can't remember. I remember very distinctly, in fear and trembling, I got up off when question time arrived. Any questions? And I got up on my feet. And I said, "Sir, what would be, you have said, sir," I think I said to the GOC, "you have said that the guns on Singapore are pointing out to sea, thus supposing that any attack from any enemy would come by sea." And I said, "What, sir, is the position if an enemy infiltrated down to Singapore towards the causeway down through Malaya?" I'm not suggesting that I was in any way a know-all about this, but it just occurred to me what would happen. And the answer from the GOC, I always recall, was, "Young man, when you have been a little longer in Malaya, you will realize that the jungles and the rubber plantations would make any enemy attack towards the causeway down through Malaya quite impossible." I remember this very distinctly, and it's always remained in my mind right the way through the war years and through the invasion of Malaya.
What was the response of the rest of the audience?
Laughter.
Directed towards whom?
Towards me.
Was there any feeling in Malaya at that time of snobbishness, as there was in India, towards what they called in India box wallers?
No, I didn't encounter it. I didn't encounter it because I played a lot of games, and we mixed the box wallers, of whom I was one, mixed on ordinary terms, easy terms, with anybody who was in government. And I didn't encounter this, except possibly once, which was up in Kuala Lumpur. And there I did listen in to a conversation, I remember, one of whom was an administrative officer who I got the impression that he was slightly contemptuous of anybody who wasn't in the at his level. There was, I believe, that in the Indian Civil Service there was an expression. The ICS, the Indian Civil Service, were referred to as the heaven-born. And I tended to think of this particular individual as one of the heaven-born. That's the only time I can remember anything of that sort.
How did you come to leave Malaya in 31?
I'll try and cut that down. I had to leave because we were taken over. The firm was taken over by a firm called Sime Darby, a well-known firm called Sime Darby. My firm had over-traded in the early 20s and was more or less being carried on by a loan from the Chartered Bank. But eventually that could no longer happen, and the bank foreclosed, and Sime Darby took over responsibilities. So that was really, it was a question of the axe for all of us.
So you just packed your bags and went home?
I was offered another job with a firm called Harper Gilfillan. Because it was offered to me by somebody with whom I played cricket, who was in a senior position in the firm, and he knew me and offered me this job. But it never came to anything because I went home. And then they cabled me saying, sorry, we can no longer offer you the job because the bottom was gradually going out of rubber and things were getting worse and worse.
How did you feel about leaving Malaya?
I didn't like going at all. I didn't want to go. I've always wished that I could get back again. But I never did.
Because you like the country?
I like the country, and I like the whole atmosphere. I like the atmosphere of the country. I enjoyed myself in the country. I enjoyed getting into Chinese shops, talking with the people. And I liked enormously what I saw of the Malays. I wasn't, I was too young to, admitted to top-notch European circles. I was simply in the games-playing circles. So that was really my, my connection. Games playing was really my connection with European society. But my main object was to see the country and see the people.
Now, if we can move on to 32, because that's when you applied for the Palestine Police. Can you tell me how that came about, please?
Yes. I was home between the end of November 31 until April 32, and I was trying as best I could to find a job, but of course it was hopeless slump conditions and jobs very difficult to find. And eventually I went to the Crown agents, and they said, all right, they said, we have some police appointments, and they said, you can go if you're found medically fit. The terms are £11 a month and everything found. And there's a draft leaving next week, and you can go on it.
Did you know anything about Palestine?
Nothing whatever. Absolutely nothing. I had vaguely I had vaguely talked with somebody who did know a little about the police, and I did anticipate fairly rough conditions, barrack room conditions. But apart from that, I knew nothing whatever.
What were your conditions of service for Palestine?
It was a 2-year contract. Much later on, in Palestine, I extended my 2-year contract to a 3rd year when I was given the option.
Were the other terms good?
There weren't very many terms, except one simply had one's pay. One was one lived in barracks. One paid normally throughout the whole of Palestine. One paid £1 a month messing, extra messing, over and above the staple diet that was produced, and on the whole, one fed reasonably well.
When you went out there, did you go with a group of others?
I went with six others, and we went out on a boat called the Largs Bay, one of the bay boats, landed at Port Said, were put by an agent onto the train for Jerusalem, and it was a night on the train up through the Sinai Desert, up to Lydda, which was a junction, then on up to Jerusalem, where we were met at the station and taken by a police tender up to Mount Scopus. And that was what I always called the old Scopus, which very few of us who were left alive probably remember. It was a huge barrack square surrounded by War One army huts. And that was really all. It was... the conditions were roughish. One was assigned to a training squad, and I think there, in the training squad there were probably about 14 or 15 of us, under a corporal, and he saw us through our, he took us through our 3 months training on the square.
What was that like?
It was tough, tough. The job of the training instructors was to instill a pretty rugged discipline into us, and there was no nonsense about it at all. The instructors were all guards, ex-guardsmen, and they operated God's methods of discipline.
Do you think it was necessary for what you had to do later?
Oh yes, I think it was very good. I think it was wonderful training. I think it knocked any conceit out of one that one might have had. It was a very good leveller, and looking back on it, I regard the Palestine police as the as a very fine university for life.
What kind of conceit might you have had, which might have been a disadvantage?
We were all young. We were from all walks of life. Some of us may have thought ourselves at the beginning better than others, which we very soon found we weren't.
What was the next stage after the training on the square?
Well, on the square, of course, not only did we have the square bashing, as I shall call it, but there were also lectures in... We were trained in law, police procedure, St. John's Ambulance, and we had classes in Arabic as well. So all that was wound up into these 3 months' training. One was instructed in the mechanism and in firing the rifle, the 303 rifle, and in revolver shooting, and in the Lewis gun. Then one passed out of the depot, which meant that you were posted, one was posted to some police unit somewhere in Palestine. I myself was kept on for 3 months playing cricket for the force, and I was employed at police headquarters doing a small job there, clerking job, during that 3 months, extra 3 months. Then I was sent down with several others to Ramleh in southern Palestine.
What was your role supposed to be there?
I was simply one of the the station personnel. For a time, I was posted to what is known as the I branch, the investigation branch. That entailed working under the Arab inspector in charge of the investigation. He couldn't speak any English, and I was only just learning Arabic, but I found that extremely good training. One got a hang of the station procedures, and one learnt a little bit about how investigations were handled. I did that for a while. Then I had to do a schedule on night duty and station orderly work, ordinary station police duties.
What type of investigations were typical at Ramleh in 1932?
Well, there were all kinds of things that went on. Cattle theft, ordinary breakings and entries, robberies, that's theft from the person.
Was that gang robberies?
I wasn't involved in a gang robbery down in Ramleh at all, in Ramleh Division at all. I was involved later on in Jerusalem